Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Back after a week of vacation, Andrew Malcolm has been waiting patiently, but he's pulling a Greta Garbo today. He won't come on camera. The prince of Twitter is acting like a prince.
I have a zit on my nose, and the royal makeup man can't fix it. No, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but
that's never stopped me before. I've been on camera with a zit on my nose, on my cheek. Because I've gotten to the age that I just don't give a darn. But I just got
breaking news, Ed, that the Chief Justice has temporarily delayed the deadline for Trump to bring the guy back from prison somewhere.
Yeah, I saw that. They had extradited somebody who was an MS-13 gang member. And the guy who represented the Department of Justice in this initial hearing, apparently just got fired because he misrepresented the government's case, either through incompetence or something else. But they've, I think, suspended him. I'm not sure that they fired him yet, but they've suspended him. And they are saying, no, this guy has had deportation orders for years that nobody's done anything about. And so now they're deporting him. And I think that may be the reason why John Roberts indefinitely suspended this, is because the court didn't properly represent what the issue was. Besides which, how do you bring somebody back? I mean, Panama doesn't release them. Panama to release them. So, I mean, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
Well, these judges, I don't know who appointed this guy, but these judges are seem very pouty and petulant and easily annoyed if it involves Trump. So,
Yes. So, yeah, great breaking news update on this. I don't know that they're necessarily going to overrule it. They may still require the Trump administration to negotiate to bring this guy back, because, look, I mean, they still haven't settled this issue as to whether or not you have to provide, you know, a separate trial for these types of things if there's already deportation orders, because generally speaking, that's not how that usually works. There is a court procedure for deportation orders, but once the orders have been issued, the federal courts just generally don't get involved in that. So we'll see. It'll be an interesting case to watch. I do think the fact that they've suspended it indefinitely gives at least a little bit of a hint, right, to where this might be going.
I'm getting tired or impatient with this is the new form of lawfare that they're doing to try to tie up Trump, everything that Trump is doing. So,
well, you know, and look, I mean, I think that the issue can be resolved and should be resolved by the Supreme Court. If not, it can be resolved by Congress, which is to require that any orders that are issued by district courts are only are limited to the district in which the court sits.
Yeah.
Which would mean an end to judge shopping outside of the District of Columbia. Now, if you're inside the District of Columbia, that's a different matter because the White House is there and it's part of that jurisdiction. But I mean, a judge in San Francisco should not, a district judge, I mean, in San Francisco should not be able to issue an order that binds every single district in the United States. That's not why you have district courts.
Now everybody's going to blame Trump for the chaos, but it's not chaos. I mean, it's clear what he wants to do. The opponents on the other side are just muddying the waters to try to tie him up in any way possible, the way they did in the first term over the wall,
right?
In DACA, yeah.
Yeah, in general, they were trying to basically keep him from being president for as long as they could possibly do so. And I think that the Supreme Court will have the opportunity here to weigh in on what jurisdiction means at a district court level pretty soon, because I think that they have to be looking at this whole judge shopping thing. And both sides do it. I don't want to be hypocritical about this. Republicans do it. They did it during Biden's presidency. They did it during Obama's presidency to a lesser degree, too. They were looking around for.
Well, since when do you get to pick? I know they do. But how is that possible? I thought you applied and then the court picks a judge.
They do, but they apply to the district and the district court picks the judge for the case. But they know which districts are more sympathetic.
And, I see. Yeah.
You know, in Florida, there is one federal district that where the judge, it's the chief judge of that district who has some say as to what, you know, cases get assigned to whom, who really has a, what's a clean way of putting it? He has
something in his ear.
He has animus towards Ron DeSantis. So anything that comes across, and he was involved in the Disney litigation, right? And he kept issuing these rulings against Ron DeSantis in the Disney litigation that the 11th Circuit kept having to overturn because it wasn't based on the law. It was based on this guy's animus towards DeSantis. So it happens. I mean, judge shopping is a thing, but the Supreme Court can put an end to it, or at least really quash most of it, by simply saying judges at the district level don't have the authority to issue nationwide injunctions. And really, honestly, there should be a better process for that anyway. If you need a nationwide injunction, it should be referred either to the Supreme Court, which is where that jurisdiction actually rests, or in some mechanism that the Supreme Court can assign or create to deal with issues that might require federal, you know, stoppages, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, this process is nonsense and it's getting abused more and more and more. And even in cases where maybe a nationwide injunction makes some sense, it's not being done in a way that's reliable. It all smells of politics by other means. And the Supreme Court really needs to step in and do something about that. Maybe they're going to do that. Maybe that's the reason why John Roberts pulled this aside. I know that Alito and Thomas particularly have been vocal about needing to intervene in these matters and put an end to them. So maybe everybody's getting a little tired of this and wants jurisdiction to rest with the Supreme Court where properly should be. And so, I love these cases anyway. I just love to watch these cases just because I think it's fascinating stuff. And I've been frustrated by this too. So, but we've got other things to discuss. Like, what did I miss while I was gone for a week? And
well, I had a raccoon on my deck.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now that's news.
I don't think you missed a lot of outrage.
I didn't miss much at all.
No, that's right. That's right. You missed that week's dose of overdose of outrage.
Oh my gosh. How will I survive?
You know, this is something that nobody can control, but I in the old days, sensational news. The tabloids would put it, like the New York Daily News or whatever, would put big headlines to get commuters to buy the paper on the way to the train station in the afternoon or the morning. And that's the way sensationalism ruled. But now, you know, there's a million places on the web, and each one does the same sort of sensationalizing of the news. And with a vague headline, it doesn't tell you exactly what happened, but it's Trump makes a startling announcement. So you feel like you should click to find out what it is. And it's clickbaiting. I love the internet. I love the whole array of sources for information, but I don't like the gamesmanship that comes in on the part of each site to jack up and hype its headlines to get the clicks. And that's what's happening. You know, it is an important story, that the tariffs, but the end of your 401k, the end of civilization, it's just all blown out of proportion. And that's what contributed to Trump's defeat in 2020, was the sense that there was chaos during his first term. there was a lot of turmoil, some of it generated by Trump, but most of it generated by the other side, trying to make it look like, oh my God, the world is coming to an end. And now, of course, they're doing the same thing. And I'm tired of it. There's no way to end it institutionally, but except maybe to write about it somehow.
Well, and fortunately, we have that opportunity. Go ahead.
I was going to make a quip that that excitement is not hot air at hot air.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. From the Prince of Twitter and the Regent of RedState.com. Always great to get the endorsement there. So I'm back. And like we've been kind of alluding, seems like things are pretty much the same. And you mentioned the panic, you know, the Wall Street Journal, which used to be a little bit better about this kind of stuff, you know, had this banner headline, you know, basically crash coming. People were talking about Black Monday this morning. And look, I mean, I looked at the stock futures and it looked pretty bleak this morning, right? It did. It looked like there was going to be a pretty huge loss. But by the end of the day, even though Trump hasn't changed anything at all about his policies, it was a minor loss, 300 points on the Dow Jones, and the other indices, something similar. I mean, it wasn't a massive crash that happened today. Now it's still down. And I'm not a fan of how the tariffs are being structured or applied. I'm willing to wait and see what a rational tariff structure will do, even though it's not my favorite policy, and I think I wouldn't opt for it. But you know, you can criticize these things without freaking out about them, and
you can't not freak out. Everyone has to freak out because it's Trump, and that's the way to get at him. And in a way, he asked for it, but in another way, he didn't. So,
well, yeah, to some extent, he does, because he hasn't really offered a rational policy, right? And not even a rational explanation for this. A lot of this just feels random, right? And they're using these calculations that really aren't based on reciprocity in terms of tariffs, but in trade imbalances. And it's a weird calculation even there. So you don't really get a sense of, well, what does this mean? What can you negotiate? There's not a whole lot of there. And that's Trump's problem. Trump has to sell this. And I don't think that Trump
you're right. Absolutely right. And even though some of his people, like Marco Rubio, I saw a video of him with a very clear explanation of why we were in this tariff problem long running back through the Cold War, because the U.S., as Europe and the rest of the world were rebuilding from the World War II, we let them take advantage of us because it was more important to have them rebuild and have a prosperous economy like South Korea than it was to keep things in balance. And now, finally, Trump is, through shock and awe, typically, is trying to correct it all at once. And I don't think it's possible to do it all at once, but this is the way he gets attention, the way he sent J.D. Vance to Europe. And remember, in where was it, February, at the security conference, where he shocked everybody with his basically grabbing him by the throat and saying, you know, Europe is going to be on its own. We may not help you anymore. And maybe there should be a NATO without the U.S., which is, you know, anathema to Europe, because they've been relying on the U.S. to carry much of their defense costs. It was a shock. In that case, I think it worked. You see a lot of the countries, especially France and Germany, reorganizing and prioritizing building up their defenses, because they may not be able to count on the U.S. being there all the time. And the reality is the U.S. won't be able to be there all the time. I mean, look, what's the most serious thing on the horizon in foreign affairs as far as the U.S. concerned. It's right. not Ukraine. It's not Ukraine. It's China.
We're
not going to be able to address Europe's security fears and Russia and Ukraine and Iran and Gaza and China all at once. You have to do it. So unfortunately, Trump isn't very eloquent in terms of explaining. Some of us had fathers who explained why they're doing something, and you learn that, well, there is a sense to this requirement or this punishment. Trump is just like, no, we're going to do it this way. And people panic, and the media feeds the panic. And we end up with irrational turmoil.
Right.
And people say, oh, my God, don't sell, for Pete's sake. Don't sell at this point in the market. I went through 1987, and the bottom fell out through that. And guess what? And I made a fortune after it. So now may be the time to buy in the market, actually.
Well, it might be, right? And again, you don't lose until you sell, basically.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think the market is an important indicator about the economy, but that's not on a day-to-day basis, right? It's on a trend basis. And So let's see how this plays out. I think that there's room for criticism, but again, you don't need to freak out in order to criticize. And there may be some, you have to keep some humility in this and saying, look, he may be working on something that will actually pay off. Let's see for a while.
Trump's problem is that the pain is up front. Remember when Obama rewarded Iran for the deal? He gave them billions of dollars up front, and then they kind of maybe sort of went partway along with complying. Well, you know, you don't get the treat before you do the trick. So you have to line things up. And Trump's policy with the tariffs is a lot of pain, and potentially a lot of pain up front. And then over time, but it's going to take longer than the midterms, over time, we're going to get some manufacturing coming back to the country. But, you know, workers have to be trained. The kids who are going to be doing this are in grade school now, or junior high or high school.
Right.
This is going to take a while, and I don't think Americans are patient. They elected Trump to fix the economy and get prices down, not boost it up, because he's got a grand vision, which is perfectly valid. It's just impractical to do at the moment, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's move on to a couple of your columns. One in particular I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about both of them, because I think they're related. I mean, your Thursday column was Trust in Media Sinks to New Low, and here's why. And I don't want to give too much away, but basically it's because the media is earning their trust rating the old-fashioned way, right?
That's very well put. It. Yeah, indeed.
You remember those ads with John Houseman for Smith Barney, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
He said, they make money the old-fashioned way. They earn it.
yeah, that's exactly right. Tastes great, less filling. Yeah. They are. And what surprised me, this is a based on a Gallup poll, what surprised me actually was digging in and finding out that the distrust or mistrust started long, long time ago, back shortly after I got into the mainstream media in the early 70s. So that was surprising to me. I mean, obviously everybody knows the bottom has fallen out as far as their credibility, but I did not realize it was on a downward trend. And then, of course, once you get the internet, and the newspapers became liberal, and we got a generation or two of reporters who wanted to fix things instead of wanted to tell stories, good stories, solid, truthful stories.
Right.
Then we got into this where enough people, a critical mass of people, have seen a story themselves, either online or on television, or they've witnessed it themselves, or they've been interviewed by television at the plane crash or whatever. And then they see the report on television and it's not really what they said. You know, as a rookie reporter, you go out, if they send you out to a big traffic crash, and if you talk to 20 people, there's 18 different versions of what happened. And the idea is to try to present a general overview that is as accurate as you can make it, talking to a whole bunch of people whose stories are all different, but there are some common threads. And what happens now is that reporters want to make a name for themselves. And so they, out of the 18 versions of the crash, they pick the one that's the most exciting, which may or may not be true. I mean, it's one person's view of an immense traffic crash. It was probably or perhaps true to them, although they were undergoing pressure at the time. But it's not a truthful depiction of what actually happened overall. And enough people have seen that, experienced that, or heard about it, that they go, you know what, I don't believe anything. And, you know, you kind of don't blame them. Trust is a very fragile thing. I think people know about it in the families. Once a serious trust is broken, you know, you can fix it with epoxy, but it's not as strong as it used to be, and it never is. So once the media, the mainstream media, loses their trust, it's, I think, probably impossible to rebuild. You're going to have to, and this is what you and I are part of and what we've been experiencing for 20 years, is the creation of an alternate media off to the side, which is forcing the mainstream media to come clean. And we're right in the middle of that, and they're resisting, and there are exaggerations, and people don't believe anybody for a while, and not everybody in our new media is honest. So it's a mess right now. So people, it puts a responsibility on the news consumer, which is why people come to hear our podcast. They have to pick the responsible, smart, fun, truthful versions of the news that they're going to invest their time in. And I think everybody, not everybody, but I think an awful lot of people pick the one that's the most exciting, most likely the first one they hear. Walking through the living room, they hear a sound bite. You know, when I started in the business, sound bites were 30, 32 seconds long on television. And now a long one is eight seconds. And if you're writing speeches for politicians, as I used to, you need to know that in your writing of the speech, that you write in a few, they call them applause lines, but if you're on television, you don't get the applause, but lines that scream to the reporter, oh, I got to show this one, because it encapsulates the message of whatever you're doing at that event, the photo op or the commemoration or whatever. I think news consumers is the only ones we can affect. Have to be wise and more conscientious about seeking what you call it, triangulation, right? Where you go and you get two or three versions and you kind of come clean, you're kind of come through the fog and see generally what you think happened and what you want to believe, the same way a reporter should do it at that car crash.
Exactly. And this leads to something else. Now, this, I don't think this was really the main topic of what you're talking about here in your second column. This was on Sunday. Scandals liberal DC media would like you to forget. And you go over a number of these scandals that they just didn't want to cover. But I'm telling you that there's one in particular that they're not covering, and it applies so much to the current situation with the media.
Yeah.
It is the fact that Joe Biden was going senile in the White House, and the media didn't want to cover it at all. And now that he's out of the White House, there's a whole new genre of literary publications now that I'm calling the "now it can be told" genre.
Yeah.
Now that he's out of office and he's lost the election, suddenly everybody in the mainstream media is interested in talking about, well, how Joe Biden wasn't really there the last, you know, couple of years of his, or at least last year. And I think it goes back a lot farther than that.
Yeah.
But suddenly they're talking about it. They weren't talking about it before the election. They weren't talking about it while it was happening.
No, because they wanted to believe it. They wanted to believe the narrative that he's sharp as a tack. And now they can't do anything about that. So they're going to make money off of telling the truth, which they should have been doing all along. You know, the media has constitutional protections for a reason, because they're supposed to be a watchdog on government. In my lifetime, I'm not sure that there's a more important story that they should have been watchdogs on than the fact that the president of the United States was out of his mind, literally. He falling asleep, he couldn't do anything, and they were signing legislation and documents with an auto pen. And we still don't know who was unelected, who was really running the government. I hope it wasn't Jill Biden, but I think it was probably her. And
Hunter.
And Hunter, oh my God, yeah, he was a White House sitting in on cabinet meetings. And, you know, God, I hope he really is clean. But then they found cocaine in the White House, the Secret Service did. So, like I said, trust. You can't believe anything once you hear or realize that so much, I mean, all politicians lie, but virtually the majority of things that Joe Biden said were lies or fables. He made things up. What his father said, what the train conductor who was dead by the time he alleges it. You know, I mean, what's her name? Michelle Obama, when she was speaking to the Olympic Committee, trying to get them to go to Chicago, she made up a story about sitting on her lap. Sitting on her father's lap and watching a great black runner in the Olympics. And so I went back and saw what year that event happened, and she would have been 18 sitting in her father's lap. So, you know, they all make up stuff, but it's occasional.
Yeah. You know,
it's to make a more important point. Biden made up, you know, oh, I was raised in a Puerto Rican neighborhood. Oh, I used to go to synagogue all the time. Well, it's all crap. He didn't do any of that. There are probably two Jews in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he was growing up. I don't think there was a synagogue for that. So you get to the point of, how do you tell? You can't tell. You just have to believe that almost anything Biden said was a lie or made up. And in his mind, it may have been, you know, what did he call it? The God's honor, or the God's truth.
God's honest truth. God's honest truth.
God's honest truth.
No joke. Oh, no joke.
Geez. Yeah, no joke. Trust me. You think I'm kidding? No, it's corrosive. I mean, to government, we got rid of him, and we got rid of his sidekick who was picked. They had nothing to do with smarts as vice president.
This is the point that I was writing about today, right? Which is, you know, I like Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. Jonathan Allen's a pretty good reporter. I'm not going to denigrate either one of them, but they're writing this book called Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House, which is firmly in the Now It Can Be Told.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And part of this is, part of what they're reporting, and this isn't them saying it, it's them saying that Kamala Harris is saying it, was that the reason why she lost is she didn't get enough support from Joe Biden. And had she had more time, you know, he pulled out too late. Had she had more time, she would have won the election. I went back and says who? I mean, all of the evidence is to the contrary. She got in, got a huge swell of support. Yes. Election racket media practically crawled up her rear end to try to cover it. And her support tanked about a couple of months in, which is exactly what happened in 2019 when she got to about second place in polling in that cycle for the Democrat primary. She got up there for a couple of months and then crashed because she's terrible at this. I'm not going to call her an idiot, but I mean, she's terrible at it. And
she's close. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe she's got some personal store of wisdom and knowledge that just simply hasn't been revealed yet, but she's had plenty of time to unveil it and it hasn't happened so far. The idea that Biden was the problem and that she didn't have enough time, both of which are nonsense. She would have been better off. And this is what I was writing. She would have been better off if Biden had bailed out in October, because she would have only been exposed for 2 or 3 weeks.
Exactly.
So, and the reason why it's important is because she wants to run for governor in California. And I mean, I think I'm not even sure California Democrats are that suicidal in terms of their long-term future by getting behind her. And same thing's true of Tim Walz to a lesser degree, because he wants to run for president. I mean, these people screwed the pooch, and they, you know, they George McGovern / Michael Dukakis their way through 2024. Then both of them think that they still have a future. And look, I mean, and again, Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen are just reporting that, right? They're not saying that, oh, yes, they do. But I mean, the idea that this is actually a thing is contradicted by all sorts of evidence. It doesn't take a genius to know that the reason why Kamala Harris was even at the top of the ticket is because Joe Biden short-circuited the ability of Democrats to hold a competitive primary or competitive choice, even the convention. Yeah. She can't compete, and he knew it, which should have told everybody. This is a mistake. Had he pulled out, and this is the thing that apparently the complaint is that he should have never run for the second term. I'm going to get to that in just a second. And had he not done that, Kamala Harris would have won the nomination, which is nonsense. She would have gotten creamed in a primary.
Yeah.
Absolutely creamed. But for her to say that Joe Biden should have dropped out rather than run for a second term, which is apparently what this book is reporting as the reason why she didn't win the presidency, she was vice president. She's part of the cover-up. She was in there cheerleading.
Absolutely.
Right up through the debate and even past the debate for Joe Biden running for a second term. If she didn't think that he was up for it, she should have challenged him in the primary, which would have been really interesting. That would have been fun to cover, right? Sitting vice president challenging a sitting president for the nomination, for the next nomination.
That would have been.
Or at least spoken up and said, look, he's not up for this. And I'm not going to stay on the ticket because he shouldn't be running for a second term. And I don't want to be part of that. So I will, if he does, I'm dropping out and I'm going to let people conclude.
That could be a movie script, but it's just not going to happen with the modern Democrat Party. And listen, let's be fair about this. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, all that crowd that were swearing he was sharp as a tack and all that until the world saw that he was a vegetable.
Sharp as a tack, running rings around his aides.
Yeah, exactly. They were part of the cover-up.
Absolutely.
And it was because they wanted to stay in power any way possible. And what I believe, people can disagree with it, but what I believe is that they hoped that he would win, because whoever was making the choices in the White House was doing it the way they wanted it done. I mean, my God, spending $5 trillion, that's one of who cares about the country. So if we keep a vegetable in there, then we can do it the way we want to do it. And the hell with the country, until 55 million people watching the debate on June 27th realized this guy's a vegetable. And then they had to do something to cover their own butts about the party, not about the country, right? They were looking for somebody who that they could run for president. And they knew that they'd be going into the swamp if they didn't pick Kamala Harris. So how do you dump the black female vice president for some Illinois governor? What do you, well, you can't do it. So they put her up knowing, I believe, full well that she was terrible. So once again, we're not thinking about the country. They know her. They know that she's an empty vessel. But they thought she might win, just possibly. We're going to lose with Joe, so maybe she'll pull it out. And if she didn't, then we get Trump again, and we can beat up on him for 4 years and clear the decks. But the going back to the basic problem is that Joe Biden said in 2019 and 20, he said, I'm going to be a transition. And that's the way he sold himself.
Right.
That he was going to, you know, which means I'll be there while everybody sorts out what's best for the party and the country. But it had nothing to do with the country. It had to do with the party. And so to avoid a messy fight, they picked Joe, and they knew they were going to face the evil demon Trump. And so, well, we can do this. We got lawfare going for us. We got all these cases against him. And they didn't count on what I come out of a lot of this with, the beyond steel, the tempered steel will and determination of Donald Trump. I mean, I don't think any of us could go through 10% of what he went through and still come out fighting on the other side. Even if revenge was your total motive, that they were just destroying his reputation, his businesses, his fortune. I mean, it's just, and he comes out and runs again and wins. You know, I mean, you don't have to like him to admire the will of that. And I'd rather have that in the White House than a vegetable who doesn't know what day it is.
At least you know who's in charge, and it's the legitimate person who got elected to the office.
And he doesn't do it in a kind way. I mean, I was sad and made a judgment in the first term when Trump went to see the Pope, and Sean Spicer, his press secretary, who's a devout Catholic, and Trump said, for whatever petty reason, no, Spicer couldn't go into the audience with him.
Yeah,
I mean, that's chicken shit. I'm sorry. That's just a guy who's being loyal to you. So that's revealing. But you know what? I don't have to be a family member of the Trumps. I don't have to be a friend of his. I don't have to send him Valentine's. He's president. He ought to be tough as a rock. And I hope he is. And I admire the determination he's shown, and I hope he keeps it on. He could do some things smarter in my mind, but I didn't go through what he did to get the job.
Well, with that, by the way, go over to redstate.com. Go look for the Prince of Twitter, Regent of Red State columns over there in the VIP section. They're both great columns. Go check those out. We are at the Jokes of the Week section of our podcast.
Oh, I had some, but I didn't pull them up.
That's okay.
I do have one.
Of course.
Okay. So let's see if I can remember the beginning of this. So an engineer dies, and he goes to heaven, and they look at the books, and God says, "No, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. You're going down there, downstairs." So they send him down to hell, and couple of months later, God checks in with the devil. They have their regular conferences about what's going on, coordination. And the devil said, hey, well, listen, before we get into it, I got to thank you for sending an engineer down here. And he says, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, that, he's brilliant. Okay. He's got air conditioning going. It's not so hot down here anymore. And he's working on an escalator. We'll have that in service in a month. The guy is amazing. He's fixing things all over the place. And God says, well, wait a minute. You got to send him back. And the devil says, like hell. God says, well, then I'm going to sue. And the devil says, well, where do you think you're going to get a lawyer?
There was a joke that was going around at the time, and I can't remember exactly how it went. But basically, an Irish lawyer dies, and he gets to the pearly gates at the same time that a pope has passed away. Right. So St. Peter greets them both and says, you know, welcome to heaven. Glad that you're here. Let me show you both to where you're going to be living. And so St. Peter takes them first to the Irish lawyer's residence, which is this really beautiful mansion on a hillside with rolling lawns and a water feature and all this. And the Irish lawyer is very, very happy and, you know, profusely thanks St. Peter. He says, it's no problem. Glad to have you. So then he takes the Pope. The Pope's thinking, well, that's what the Irish lawyer gets. I must really have some cool digs up here. So he takes the Pope to this, you know, this nice little cabin sort of nestled in the woods, you know, about, you know, bedroom, bathroom, you know, just a little bit of ground. And the Pope's looking around. He's looking kind of, you know, rustic. And he's going, wait a minute. He says, why did that guy get the big, huge mansion and I just get this little cabin? And St. Peter says, look, you got to understand, we have hundreds of popes here, but this is the first Irish lawyer we've ever had.
This is the first lawyer we ever got.
I got another one for you. And this one's actually clean. I actually had two others queued up. I'm only going to do one though, because the other one's a little dirty. So this one's a kind of a clean one. So this father of five, you know, goes to an event and he wins this raffle, and it's this really nice, you know, kid's toy that he wins, but it's only one, right? So he comes home and he calls the kids together and says, look, I just got this toy. I can only give it to one of you. You know, I think we need to make a decision here as to who's going to get this. And this is how we're going to determine this. Who's the most obedient, who never talks back to mother, and who does everything she says? And the kids put their heads together and they break up looking pretty downhearted. And he says, well, what's your decision? And they said, well, I guess it's you, Dad. I was listening to mother. Hey-o. That's it for this week's podcast. I'm glad to be back. And next week, Andrew might even show his face around these digs. You know, I'll work. He's got to have his standards. But next week, we might even talk him into showing his face around here.
I don't want to scare everybody, but okay.
No. You're the draw here, man. We got to get you on camera next week. Just for everybody's knowledge, it was technical issues today, but we did get them on audio, and that's good enough.
we had another good talk.
You know what, next week maybe I'll just have you on camera the whole time and I'll just be audio.
Oh boy, then I can't sneak my Diet Coke drinks. Well, okay.
Oh, whatever. So that's what I've been sneaking my little Canada Dry drinks here while we've been talking. So Andrew Malcolm, the Prince of Twitter, at AH Malcolm on Twitter. The Regent of Redstate.com is VIP columns over there. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.